from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. President Donald Trump said in a tweet this week that immigration enforcement agents are planning to arrest, quote, millions of migrants. Detention centers for migrants seeking asylum and immigrants in the country illegally are already packed beyond capacity. Earlier this month, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General released a report outlining evidence of rotting food, inadequate medical care, and excess force in detention centers for adults, stating that conditions are so bad they amounted to, quote, egregious violations. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ignited a debate this week when she called the facilities concentration camps. So this hour on Point, what's really happening inside U.S. detention centers? And you can join us. What needs to be done to improve the conditions at immigrant detention centers? Should the U.S. be detaining fewer people or just making sure fewer migrants make it to the border? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And by the way, a little later this hour, we will discuss the present and future of the U.S.'s most expensive weapon system in history, the F-35. But let's spend a considerable amount of time talking about conditions inside U.S. detention centers. And joining me first from Phoenix, Arizona, is Astrid Galvan, a border and immigration correspondent for the Associated Press. Astrid, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
So first of all, I think because the immigration system is a little complicated in the United States, I was wondering if you just might explain clearly when, for example, when a migrant seeking asylum or a family arrives at the southern border, which branch of government, who processes them first and where do they go?
So the first branch of government they're going to come into is Customs and Border Protection. That's the parent agency of the Border Patrol and the Office and Field of Operations, which is the people who are at the actual ports, not, you know, out patrolling on the border like the Border Patrol does. Typically, if someone crosses the border outside of those official border crossings, they will come in contact with a Border Patrol agent, and the Border Patrol agency processes them. In most cases, the Border Patrol then transfers them to the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also widely known as ICE. And then ICE, if their families, usually releases them, you know, with pending court dates, expecting that they will check in with them wherever their final destination is, because most of the people who are coming up, especially people from Central America, they're not, you know, they're not going to stay at the border. They're looking to meet up with relatives all over the country.
Okay, so let's first talk about some of the conditions then inside the facilities run by Customs and Border Protection, because you just reported a few days ago that we have advocacy groups saying that inside some of these facilities, the conditions are incredibly overcrowded, meager food, some places where people are being forced to sleep on bare ground during dust storms. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, the places where immigrants are held when they are held by CBP have been, you know, an issue for many years. It's an amplified issue now because there are so many people and especially so many families with children. And the reality is that the Border Patrol just doesn't have the capacity or resources to even process such a large number of people. So what happens is that they end up waiting for days in these extremely overcrowded facilities. We're talking about people standing on toilets just to make space while they can get them processed. And what that means is, you know, get them medically screened, take their information down, make sure that they don't have a prior criminal record in the United States, et cetera, before they can actually release them either, you know, on their own recognizance, which is increasingly happening again because all of the agencies are so strained, or release them to ICE.
Right. So I'd like to examine this in detail, Astrid, if we could. What you just said about processing facilities that are so overcrowded that people have to stand on toilets to make space, I mean, how long are they in those kinds of rooms?
They can be in there for weeks at a time. They're not supposed to be in there for more than 72 hours, but a majority are. And that's what this report found by the DHS Office of the Inspector General, is that majority of people were spending several days and some even weeks in these facilities waiting to be processed.
Where there's only standing room?
Correct.
I mean, So what is the impact on the people then who have to stand for days or weeks in a jam-packed room that's designed for, what, 150, but there may be several hundred people in it?
Right. Well, I think one of the biggest consequences that we've seen so far is the spreading of illnesses. When you're in these tiny quarters in extremely close contact with people, illnesses spread very quickly. There was a flu outbreak at the McAllen Processing Center in Texas, also known as Ursula, that ended up shutting it down a couple of weeks ago I think it only shut down for maybe a day. But that's been probably the biggest issue that's arisen, other than, you know, obviously people feeling like they are not being treated civilly and that they are, you know, suffering this consequence of having crossed the border is being in these, you know, tiny spaces.
But just to underscore what we're saying now and what the Office of the Inspector General at DHS is saying is that there are facilities run by the United States federal government on U.S. soil right now where people are being detained and they have to, in certain circumstances, stand in jam-packed rooms, stand for days, possibly even weeks.
Right.
Okay. I just want to underscore that that is what our own federal government is reporting about what our government is doing. What about food? I mean, we've been hearing about food and about other sort of health and well-being related realities in these detention centers. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so there's always been this complaint about the quality of food that detainees are given when they are in CBP custody. It's usually, you know, pre-packaged food like burritos. A couple of problems is it's food that may be customary to us in the United States, but it's not at all customary to people from certain regions of Latin America, and so, or even other countries. And so, you know, they don't like it. They don't feel like it's enough food. A lot of them say that they, you know, go hungry. And CBP says, you know, the best food practices, the safest food practices is to give those prepackaged foods as opposed to, you know, cooking food there just because of the safety issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your story for the AP from June 14th, you also mentioned, maybe some people had already heard about this, that at least in one case, there was a young teenage mother who had given birth to a premature baby who was in one of these facilities for days. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So she is a Guatemalan 17-year-old girl. She had an emergency C-section in Mexico in early May and then ended up crossing the Rio Grande. People had to carry her through the river because she was in a lot of pain from complications from the cesarean. And she ended up in Border Patrol custody first at an initial station, and then she was transferred to this processing center in McAllen. And she was there for several days. People probably wouldn't have known about her except that an advocacy group that goes and does these inspections came across her. And the volunteer who did that, you know, she was shocked that this young girl who was wheelchair bound because she was in so much pain from her C-section was with this, what she described as, you know, very minuscule, tiny baby.
Mm. So, Astrid, let me ask you, you yourself have been inside some of these facilities. I understand the last detention center you were able to visit was one in Nogales in Arizona. When was that?
That was in 2014, and that was a temporary facility that's since been closed.
It's since been closed. Okay. So what is, tell us more about what Customs and Border Protection, what DHS is saying about why the conditions seem to be as worrying, frightening as they are, and do they have plans on fixing this situation?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. You know, CBP also has concerns for its Border Patrol agents because they're in the same facilities that these people are held in. And so they're, you know, they express a lot of concern about their agents also getting sick. They express concern also about the safety of agents. In fact, in this Office of Inspector General report, they address that their agents fear with so many people crowded that there might, you know, tensions might rise and it might create a safety situation. That's what they say. They're, you know, building more structures. In El Paso, there's an outdoor structure that professor recently compared to a human dog pound in a story in the Texas Monthly. And they're building a centralized processing center in El Paso also that's expected to open within 18 months.
The Trump administration, as far as I understand, would point the finger at Congress, though, because the administration has asked for additional funding to manage this, the influx of migrants coming to the southern border. And they would say that Congress is not loosening the purse strings for that.
Right. They have been advocating for emergency funding. I think that the Senate may have approved some emergency funding yesterday. Mm. I'm not sure what the status is. But yes, they have been asking for more money.
Okay. So, I mean, given how long you've been following this story, Astrid, just give me your sense. I mean, you're a reporter there on the ground. How bad is it?
It's pretty bad in terms of, you know, the number of people and the ability to have them in, you know, safe, not crowded conditions, especially when it comes to children. You know, children are a vulnerable population. It might be a lot easier for an adult to stand around in a, you know, detention center for a few days, but that's a whole different story for a child. And so I think both the government and the advocates will tell you that the situation is quite dire.
Well, we are talking about the reality of what's going on inside detention centers on U.S. soil that are holding migrants seeking asylum and also immigrants in the country illegally. There was a report issued by the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security earlier this month that said some of the conditions constitute egregious violations. And we want to know what your reaction is to that. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about conditions inside U.S. detention centers that are holding migrants seeking asylum and immigrants in this country illegally. Let's listen to what Senate Homeland Security Chairman Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, said when he visited a border control processing facility last month following a flu outbreak that led to the death of at least one detainee, a 16-year-old boy. Here's Johnson on CBS's Face the Nation.
We're all concerned. They had an outbreak of flu. They believed it might have been H1N1, highly dangerous. But the process centers are back open, but they are grossly overcrowded because of the unbelievable situation on the border, the out-of-control nature of it.
Well, Democratic Congressman Jason Crow spoke on MSNBC's Morning Joe last month about legislation that he has introduced that would require immigration agencies to grant members of Congress access to these detention centers. About a month earlier, Crow was turned away from an ICE facility in his home state of Colorado when he wanted to learn about the health conditions of detainees there.
I can't get to this detention center. It's hard to get oversight and information. So this is just about good government and transparency and making sure that taxpayer money is being used the right way and that what's happening in this facility is consistent with the values of our community. So we're going to work hard to get bipartisan support for this because I don't think this is a political issue. I think everyone should be interested in making sure that we know what's happening with our government agencies and we have oversight.
That's Democratic Congressman Jason Crow last month. Let's go to the phone. Steve is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
In my view, this is nothing short of fascism. The person in the Oval Office requires an loyalty oath. And he is now running for re-election, pandering to his base, and he is going to round up millions of people, irrespective of the ability to care for them, feed them, house them, do anything on a humane basis. To me, it looks like a Kristallnacht against brown people.
Well, Steve, thank you for your call. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Monroe, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air.
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I was actually born and raised in Phoenix metro area, and it irritates me that they want to pour all this money into all this stuff when there's actual Americans. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, if you want to come to this country, come in the front door, by all means, more power to you. But like I said, come in the front door. And then people want to complain, well, they're being treated inhumane. Well, not really. I mean, they're here illegally. They're criminals to start off with. I mean, it boggles my mind. Everyone's to blame the president. It's not his fault.
Yeah, Dave, can I ask you a question?
You trace it all the way back to the '80s.
Yeah, can I just ask you a quick question, Dave? I hear what you're saying. When you say they're criminals, they're here illegally. But as far as I understand, we don't even treat criminals who are in U.S. prisons the way that we're hearing these migrants are being treated in the detention facilities. Like, I don't know of a single U.S. prison where hundreds of people are kept in one room, forced to stand for days on end.
And you're 100% correct on that. But the problem with that is that they're not built to withstand that amount of people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we have to first and foremost, we got to tighten up the borders or stop the flow of people coming in so that, I mean, we're just going to stop and build whole new detention centers for thousands and thousands of people. And then when the flow stops, what happens to these buildings? They just are abandoned. I mean.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thank you so much for your call. I'm joined today by Astrid Galvan. She's a border and immigration correspondent for the Associated Press with us from Phoenix. And I want to introduce into the conversation now J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda, lawyer at the Immigration Law Clinic and University of California Davis School of Law. He helps represent children in government custody as part of the Flores Settlement. That was that 1997 agreement between the government and immigrant advocacy groups about the detention of migrant children. And he's visited several detention facilities across the country, including one in Homestead, Florida. That's the largest facility for migrant children in the country. J.J. Mulligan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, just tell us what you saw inside the Homestead facility when you visited in February.
Well, when I visited in February, there was still around, I believe there's 1,800 or 2,000 kids then, and it was just so crowded that you can't even imagine where they would possibly hold more kids. But now that's close to 3,000 people, apparently. There were rooms where there was 144 bunk beds, and kids were just, when you walk by the bunk beds, you can barely get by. They're just shoulder length apart. They separate siblings. If one of the siblings is 17 and the other's, 13, they separate them on different sides of the facility, and they only see each other once a week. At times they've used solitary confinement. So it's a really rough place to be. Yes.
Why?
It depends. In one instance, there was a trans youth, and they said they were doing it for her own protection.
And how long?
I believe in that case it was 10 days.
I mean, was that a legitimate concern for her protection, though? I mean, that actually sounds like ostensibly a reason to want to isolate someone if they are in danger.
Well, isolation included, you know, 10 days not leaving a room without a window. Mm. So there's a fine line between protection and suffering.
So is it the crowding that's the primary cause of what seems to be a degradation of conditions in these facilities, or is it something else?
Well, I think we've seen from the beginning that the Trump administration has used mistreatment as a form of deterrence. And when that's the main plan, then things like overcrowding and these incredibly unsanitary conditions, the idea is that that will get back to people fleeing their countries and trying to come here, and that will work as sort of, you know, a metaphorical wall for people not to come.
But apparently that's not working, right? Because in May, Border Patrol agents, as far as I see these numbers, and Astrid, please correct me if I'm wrong, but in just 1 month, there were, more than 130,000 apprehensions in May. So the deterrence it's not deterring people.
Exactly. And so it becomes this awful game of chicken where the government is just making conditions worse and worse and not caring about it. And immigrants are still coming because the conditions in their home country that are pushing them here have not changed.
Huh. Well, let's take some more calls here because we've got some interesting perspectives on this. July is calling from Speedwell, Tennessee. July, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
My sentiment was kind of like doing any other crime. If you were a citizen of the United States, wouldn't Mexican citizens have a foreshadowing of what they may have to go through before they cross the border illegally and maybe try to come in the right way?
July, thank you so much for your call. So Astrid Galvan, let me turn back to you here. That's the second call that we've heard, who said that, you know, this deterrence factor should work, or it's not a problem that migrants are being treated this way, because it should be a message to those who wish to try to cross the border. And what's your response to that?
Well, I hear that a lot about coming through the front door, but the reality is that there really isn't a front door. It's not like it used to be. It's incredibly difficult. It takes years, and a lot of money to come into the United States legally. You know, people who are coming here, they're fleeing emergency situations. They don't have time or money to get in. And I will add that there are people who are trying to come in what was referred to as a front door. And there are thousands and thousands of people waiting on the Mexican side of the border, waiting to seek asylum. And the government isn't letting them in. So I think that's a general misconception, maybe misunderstanding of how our immigration system works. There is no easy way to get here legally. It's extremely cumbersome. And people just can't do it.
Mm. Well, J.J. Mulligan, Sepulveda, tell us a little bit more. I really, one of the things I hope to get from our conversation with the two of you is a detailed sense, again, of what's actually happening. Because people haven't had access to these facilities, reporters or lawmakers, for a while. So I guess February isn't all that long ago for when you visited. Tell us more in more detail. What did you see?
Well, so when you visit a detention facility, and there's basically three kinds. There's the Customs and Border Protection, the CBP facility along the border. There's the ICE ones. And then there's the ORR, Office of Refugee Resettlement, which has the jurisdiction over unaccompanied minors that are under 18 and come here without a parent. And so there's three different facilities, and what you see when you go to the facility, and what I've spoke with members of Congress about, is that you can pretty up on the outside what they look like. The Homestead facility, I've heard people go there and say, oh, it looks like a summer camp. But when you sit down and talk with the children, which is one of the things we have access to as part of the Flores Settlement Agreement, when you sit and talk with the children, the story is completely different. And let's not forget, we're talking about kids that have suffered extreme trauma in their home countries, and that have suffered extreme trauma on the journey here. And then they're just basically put in these cells for extended periods of time. And it's horrifying to see and to hear about.
Well, let's go to Jake, who's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Jake, you're on the air.
Hello. I just have a quick question. In the New York Times, they had a bill that said that there's $4.6 billion in aid to advance help the cause of the everything down there. What are your thoughts on this bill? Is this going to help at all?
Are you talking about an appropriations bill in Congress?
Yes.
Okay. So, Jake, thank you so much for your call. Astrid, do you have a response for that?
I'm sorry. I really don't. I haven't been following this that closely.
Okay. And J.J. Mulligan, Sepulveda, do you know what Jake's talking about?
Yes. And I think it just got out of the Appropriations Committee, mm-hmm. and now it's going to go to the larger Senate. I didn't see the full details of it, but I think there is some pretty major issues still with it.
Okay. So one more question about the homestead facility in Florida here. I'm seeing that there was a 700-page court document filed by lawyers who spent some time inside the detention center. Were you one of the lawyers who helped file that document?
Well, yeah, it was part of our team. And it's 700 pages because it included hundreds of declarations from the young children that were in the facility and that we spoke with, detailing numerous unsafe and unsanitary conditions within the facility and the basic mistreatment as well.
Okay, calling it prison-like. So given the push from advocacy groups and lawyers such as you, JJ, for example, the Office of Inspector General report we have on certain ICE facilities, are these the tools of accountability or of pressure to be able to change what the conditions are inside these facilities? I mean, what are the responses from CBP and from ICE on this?
You know, it's tough to tell. On Tuesday, for example, the government was in the Ninth Circuit arguing that safe and sanitary, which is a requirement of the Flores Settlement Agreement, that kids be in these safe and sanitary conditions. They're arguing that that doesn't include soap and toothbrushes, you know. And so it's hard to get too optimistic about what that Inspector General report's doing and what these other things are doing. It seems like it's more and more just falling on deaf ears. And the idea is to just mistreat migrants and try and do everything possible to stop anyone from fleeing for their lives from these countries.
Okay, but Astrid Galvan, let me ask you about that, though, because, I mean, the Inspector General's report is very pointed, right? Does it not call for specific changes that need to be made in these facilities?
Yes, but the government's response is that they are doing what they can. I think that the response over and over again has been, you know, they feel like their hands are tied. They don't feel like they have the funding. That's been their response.
So is money the heart of the question here? I mean, for example, if Congress were to provide further appropriations, would the administration then does it have the plans in place to how to use that money to relieve the problems?
Well, it seems to me like, for example, the homestead facility, youth there, it costs $775 a day per child to hold kids there. And so the government is paying this private corporation all of this money, and they're spending money all over the place. And then they're crying poverty now as if they, you know, don't have any money to fund these things anymore. And it was pretty clear based on the statistics what was going to be happening. And they've done very irresponsible things with their funding already. And so that was, I think, part of the sticking point with the appropriations bill, that how are we going to know what you're going to spend this on?
Interesting. You know, I'm just looking once again, I'm glancing at the beginning of the Inspector General's report here. And just in case people were wondering about the veracity of what we're talking about, The DHS Inspector General itself said our observations confirmed concerns identified in detainee grievances, which indicated unsafe and unhealthy conditions to varying degrees at all of the facilities we visited. So they're confirming what people are saying about what's happening in there. So, Astrid Galvan, just we've got a minute and a half left here to go. I wonder if you see the possibility of this changing in the near future, or are conditions just going to get worse?
Well, I can't predict anything. I can tell you that generally over the summer, arrivals drop off. Just because it gets really hot and not as many people travel. But no, I can't. I couldn't tell you.
And J.J. Mulligan, same question to you.
What was the question again? I'm sorry.
Are things simply going to get worse if there aren't sort of the structural changes or the desire to make the structural changes, even if for Congress provided more funding to improve conditions in these facilities?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration is really focused on impeding anyone from coming to the United States. And so if they're going to get more money, I believe they're going to spend it on that as opposed to giving sort of the basic sanitary conditions that are necessary.
Well, J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda, lawyer at the Immigration Law Clinic at the University of California Davis School of Law, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Astrid Galvan, border and immigration correspondent for the Associated Press, with us from Phoenix, Arizona. Astrid, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to note that we did reach out to Customs and Border Protection and ICE as well for their comment or participation in today's program. We did not hear back from them. When we come back, we'll talk about the F-35, the United States' most expensive weapon system in history. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Department of Defense has been at work on the F-35 for 20 years. The fighter jet is supposed to be the next generation of joint strike aircraft systems for the U.S. Navy, Air Force, and Marines. It is the most expensive weapons program in American history. Now, the F-35's lifetime operational costs are estimated to be more than $1 trillion. The Pentagon had planned to end the F-35's development phase at the end of this year and move toward full production next year. But the aircraft still has more than 900 deficiencies, some of which may threaten pilot safety. So we're going to take a look at that right now, and you can join the conversation. How do you feel about your taxpayer dollars going to the development of this jet to the tune of $1 trillion? And what's your response to the idea that the F-35 may be pushed into full production while it still has hundreds of deficiencies? And we're joined now from Washington by Anthony Capasio, defense reporter for Bloomberg News. Tony Capasio, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for inviting me.
So first of all, give us a little bit of like the sort of the bottled history of the F-35. It's been in development for two decades. What's the overall goal for this new fighter system?
That's a good description you gave. Former Pentagon officials have said it's had a tragic past. Tragic, defined as causing excessive sorrow or extreme caution, and that's kind of true. The award of this thing was in October of 2001, about 3 weeks after we invaded Afghanistan. The promise was high, the most mature design ever in an aircraft, We'll have these in the field in 5 or 6 years. It'll cost about $233 billion to develop and then buy them. Now we are 19 years later. It's up to $428 billion. The plane's initial combat capabilities were about 5 to 6 years late. And while there's some light at the end of this long runway tunnel, there's still a lot of questions to be answered about future costs and reliability improvements.
Okay, so we're going to talk about all that. But I just want to know, like, ideally, this was supposed to be this state-of-the-art joint strike aircraft, right, for the Navy, the Air Force, Marines, and also for foreign militaries as well?
Right. The image was that one plane would have 80%, they would have 80% common parts. It would be a flying computer, which it is now, with 8 million lines of code. It would be able to distribute digital information at the speed of light between airplanes, Army units, Navy units, and fourth-generation fighters like the F-15 and F-16 that aren't stealthy. The reality is not there yet. They're demonstrating some nascent capabilities, but it's not 80% common parts anymore. It's much lower than that. But on the other hand, this thing is embedded in about 12 different nations around the world. Japan is buying the most. Japan, the United Kingdom, and Australia are the big, and Turkey, by the way, are the largest customers for this airplane at the moment.
How much are they willing to pay for it?
You know, that's a question the Italian Parliament has grappled with, the Canadian government grappled with, and they decided not to buy any F-35s at the moment. This was about 3-4 years ago. So, yeah, questions about the plane that come out of the United States ripple through the universe.
Through the universe. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Tony, but I just want to also ask, so the chief contractor for the F-35 was Lockheed Martin, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so let me just play a little bit of tape here, because like you said, you mentioned sorrow. And we'll get to sort of where we are now, but I want to play a moment from the late Senator John McCain and former chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. This was in 2016 when he pointed out the then many problems with the F-35.
The F-35's program's record of performance has been both a scandal and a tragedy with respect to cost, schedule, and performance. And it's a textbook example of why this committee has placed such a high priority on reforming the broken defense acquisition system.
So late Senator John McCain in 2016. Mm-hmm. But Tony, here we are now in 2019. What are the major problems? I mean, we mentioned the 900 deficiencies with this super sophisticated airplane. What's going on?
All right. So here's some context here. It entered its full-blown combat testing in December. That in itself is about 2 years late. This is the testing designed to determine whether we can go against the most sophisticated Russian and Chinese air defenses, and Iraqi air defenses for that matter, Iranian air defenses for that matter. It finishes that testing later this year or early next year, and that's going to be determining whether it's operationally capable and operationally suitable. It means it can be maintained. We don't know that yet. We know that it has emerging capabilities, and it has been used in combat a few times. It was used in combat in Afghanistan last year, Iraq, and in Syria, attacking ground targets. The deficiencies you talk about, of the 900 and roughly 15 that it went into the testing with, about 15 or 16 of those are what they call Category 1, the must-fix potential safety problems that right now they're flying with, working around those issues. Lockheed and the Pentagon say they have solutions for all of them, but the problem is they keep cranking these planes out. Congress keeps adding planes. The backlog and the number of planes delivered keeps growing, and those all have to be retrofitted to pay to correct these deficiencies. Those are going to be retrofitted at the cost of like $15 to $16 million a plane.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot of money. So that's a to-go unfunded liability issue that this program faces. But those deficiencies, I wouldn't let the listeners think that these are flying death traps.
Okay.
That is just not true.
But we're seeing, I mean, some of the headlines are saying that some of these deficiencies could threaten pilot safety.
Yeah, coulds and coulds. This program has had a really amazing history of safety. It's had its first crash was last September. The pilot survived. He parachuted out. And then the second crash, unfortunately, the Japanese pilot who died in a crash, they still don't know reasons for, but it has not had a major history of safety issues caused by deficiencies. I need to make that point.
Okay. So that's good context then. But in a normal defense procurement and development process, though, do we reach this point? Because I understand that the Pentagon would like to push the plane into full production next year. Do we frequently reach this point with this many deficiencies, or is this kind of unusual?
This is unusual in terms of the size and scope of the deficiencies, no question about it. But there's enormous pressure to get this plane moving. It's got 15,000 suppliers in like 45 states. Even Susan Collins in Maine, who signed out on a letter recently that the Texas delegation floated around to push the F-35, she signed on to it. And I thought, why the heck would she be interested in this? She's got a Pratt & Whitney engine subcontractor in one of the towns. So the tentacles are all over the country and the world. And there's this tendency to move forward. Without Senator McCain, this program has pretty much been on autopilot as far as Congress is concerned. They keep adding planes every year.
Autopilot? And now, but I quoted a number, which you didn't say is wrong, that the lifetime, the expected lifetime cost for the F-35 program is more than $1 trillion. That's a lot of money for autopilot.
Oh, no kidding. This is the support part of it. It's $428 billion in development and procurement. Mm-hmm. On top of that is this $1.1 trillion for the next – that's like 50 years of support. But I tell you, when the number came out in early 2011, that was sticker shock magnified by 1,000%.
Wow.
That scared the heck out of a lot of people. And they're still trying to grapple with it.
Well, let's listen to what Lockheed Martin itself is saying about this, because a reporter for Defense News, Valerie Insinna, spoke with Greg Ulmer at the Paris Air Show earlier this week. Now, Ulmer is the vice president and general manager of the F-35 program for Lockheed Martin Corporation, and here's their interaction.
I'm wondering, you know, looking forward, at what point do you think that some of those are going to be able to be eliminated or downgraded? Because I know there's also a process involved there, too.
Sure. So, you know, they're each kind of, you know, we tried to address each one specifically in our response. But, you really do have to look at each one specifically. None of them are safety related.
Yeah.
Many of them already have fixes in play. It's just we have to complete the work to get them incorporated into the aircraft.
So that's Greg Ulmer, Vice President and General Manager of the F-35 program at Lockheed Martin. Tony Capasio, what's your response to Ulmer's very, I would say, calm assessment of where they are in the F-35's development?
Yeah, the calm assessment is this. GAO and others have said the Pentagon, before it goes into full rate production, the plane goes into full rate production, they need to fix the preponderance of these deficiencies or demonstrate they have a plan to quickly fix them after accelerated contracts are signed. We've heard this tune before, but going into testing with like 916 deficiencies, 15 of those being Category 1, not a good thing. This is why you need Congress to aggressively oversee the program. Right now, you got the General Accounting Office, who comes out with a report once a year. You got the Pentagon's Test Office that comes out with a report once a year. There's a flurry of news stories, and then it kind of dies. So now it's up to the Pentagon bureaucracy, the Air Force, Navy, and Marines, to aggressively ensure that there's a plan forward, especially to fix the Category 1 deficiencies.
Right. And I mean, certainly they would be motivated to do that, right? Because this is the weapon systems that they will be using, that their soldiers will be operating. I mean, they must be motivated to be sure that these Category 1 deficiencies get worked out.
Clearly. No, they definitely. And in fact, the new Marine Corps commandant is their former head of their buying command. He's very well aware of the issues with the B model. It's the one that can fly. It can land vertically.
Okay.
This has been the most problematic of the versions. It's the most complicated of the airplanes. And the prior Marine Corps commandants have been really hands-on. The new one is going to be even more hands-on. So, yeah, I'm confident that these, especially the Category 1 deficiencies, either they'll solve or at least have a great plan forward, a plan forward that shows solutions fairly soon next year.
Well, let's take a couple of calls here. Zach is calling from Bradenton, Florida. Zach, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're still with you, Zach. Go ahead.
Hey. Awesome. Hey, I've got so many comments. I don't even know where to begin. So I'm a former Army Ranger with the United States military, and I have had some time around the F-35 and kind of seen a little bit of what it can do and what it can't do. Now, what I have come into contact with, and especially seen, is that there's huge problems with this vertical landing, vertical takeoff, landing and takeoff platform, where basically the prop behind the turbine prop behind the cockpit that's actually used for the stabilization and the main thrust for this vertical landing, vertical takeoff is yet to be fully bugged out. And this is an ongoing problem they've had since, I believe, since 2007 or 2008, when they first tried to put this aircraft on an aircraft carrier to actually see if it actually can do what the Harrier, which we already have in service, already can do. And I kind of feel like there's already weapons platforms, aerial weapons platforms, as far as like maybe, you know, the F-35 or maybe the F-18, for example, where it's what's the real advantage for this F-35? Where is all this money really? Why is there such a support to want to get this project going? And I feel like that this is really an outdated technology at this point to throw a lot of large money of tax dollars at. So what I feel like is just going to be shipped to other countries, so they have an inferior air defense system that is going to be something that we have already have a trump to in place of. That's already 20-year-old technology.
Right.
So I guess what I'm saying is this really a primary example of us kind of using a weapons platform to say, look how great this thing is, vertical landing, vertical takeoff, which that's yet to be fully bugged out. And then in the same breath, are we just using this to sell to other people so that we still maintain air defense superiority?
Right. Well, Zach, thank you so much for your call. Zach, a former Army Ranger there who's worked on the F-35. Mm-hmm. Tony Capasio, he's said a lot there. Let's kind of start in the middle with what he said, because I'm curious about, he asked, like, what is actually sort of the operational superiority of the F-35 versus systems that the U.S. military already has?
Okay, it's the stealth capability and the sensors and the onboard computers that this is a promise yet to be totally realized. So the idea is it's a flying quarterback able to call audibles and then call also specific plays, but send out information to other non-stealthy fighters and to the ground, to ground units, to Ranger units, special ops units, which Rangers are also, but conventional units. That hasn't been fully demonstrated yet. The F-35 and the F-22, our other stealthy fighter, they can't really talk to each other in terms of yet linking sophisticated data between the two. That's a real problem they need to fix. He said something interesting about the technology already being outmoded. Well, there's another upgrade for this program called the Block 4. It's about $28 billion, we're learning, and this is going to be going forward. Planes already built now are going to have to be modified with Block 4 dollars. This program raises all sorts of problems in terms of cost, schedule, performance, and whether Lockheed has got the engineering support that can even support this new upgrade. So that's lurking out there. The Ranger Zach made a good point about the technology. Is it already outmoded? And then the issue of ground support. This was originally sold as being able to provide ground support, close air support for guys and women on the ground, and that's still to be determined.
Yeah.
The attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, those are ground attacks on ISIS and Taliban units. There's war not in support of U.S. troops.
Well, we have one last question here. We've just got about 30 seconds left to go, Tony. But Amy Bradley says, considering the entire process related to this aircraft, the question shouldn't be why is it being pushed into production, but rather why has it not been canceled? And why has the bidding process not been completely reworked?
It's too big to fail. This has been a trite label hung on it, but I've been covering this since the day it was awarded. And I've kind of come to that conclusion. There's too many players with vested interests. There's too many people that want this to succeed, and I think it will succeed eventually, but the question is at what cost and what opportunity cost for other programs. It's competing with Marine Corps, programs, two new submarine programs the Navy's pushing. So,
too big.
That's
to
the
fail.
Challenge.
Yeah. Well, Anthony Capasio, defense reporter for Bloomberg News, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Great, and thank you for having me on. I hope I was able to illuminate this a little bit.
Most certainly were. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.